All right. Good morning, everybody. My name is Ethan Bellamy. I'm with Baird. Thank you for being here today. We're running a little behind, so I'm going to speed things up. We've got a Texas-focused panel today, so I'm going to let our presenters briefly state who they are and what their company does, and then we'll dive in. So, Eric, why don't you get us started, please?
Hi, good morning. Eric Calamaris with American Midstream Partners. We are predominantly focused in the Gulf of Mexico and have also gathering processing assets across the Permian, Eagle Ford, East Texas, and in the Bakken.
I'm Chuck Ward, CFO for Sanchez Production Partners. We're Eagle Ford focused in connection with Sanchez Energy and moving their volumes and processing.
John Bookout, Chief Financial Officer, Noble Midstream Partners, with assets in the DJ Basin and the Permian.
Randy Burkhalter, Vice President of Investor Relations at Enterprise, and we have a Permian and Eagle Ford presence as well as South Texas, and just really interested in this, so thank you.
You're being modest, Randy.
Yeah. All right, guys, kind of a softball question to get us started. Where do you think you're going to see the most growth, and where do you plan to deploy capital in the upcoming year? John, why don't you get us started?
Sure. Pretty easy question for us. Our capital will follow our sponsor, Noble Energy. We'll probably spend 50% of our capital budget for 17 and 18 in the DJ Basin, with the balance in the Permian.
And similar for us with Sanchez Energy's closing on the Anadarko acquisition yesterday. Actually, that will commit for probably foreseeable 2 to 3 years that all of our development capital, expansion capital, will be headed into Eagle Ford and moving those volumes out of that basin and headed east and or north.
Yeah, I would say for American Midstream, our view on the Permian continues to be that the basin will continue to outperform probably initial expectations already. We've seen a pretty nice resurgence there over the past several years. We expect that to continue over the next several years. We've talked and heard a lot about pipeline capacity constraints over the next 18 to 24 months. Our internal view is that's likely to be true. And I would suspect that we spend a fair bit of our M&A capital in the Permian over the next 18 to 24 months, doing it in a way that we think is responsible as it relates to rate of return. There are some threshold levels that are pretty lofty out there, and we have not participated or been successful, but we're close to some things, and we expect to do that over time.
Discounting petrochemicals, just looking at the NGL and crude oil side of our businesses, we're focused on the Delaware primarily for the NGL takeaway and for the rich gas. But the crude oil, for our Midland Sealy crude oil pipeline, which is due to come on at the end of this year and really start operations early 18, is, of course, a Midland connection at our terminal there. So we really are excited about the Permian and the possibilities there. And if you read the analyst notes that are coming out, you're looking at 3 million plus barrels a day of supply and demand kind of balancing in 19 and probably 18, 19 time frame, and then maybe you need more takeaway after that, depending on who you read.
So Randy, am I an idiot if I go spend $45,000 an acre buying Delaware Basin? I mean, because the question is the Permian a bubble? We do a survey every quarter, and we get people saying the Permian is beachfront property, and it's fantastic, and other people saying this is a house of pain that is a bubble, and it's going to end very, very badly for a lot of people.
We like the fact that, being a midstream, that producers and companies are doing that, because that means they're going to be looking for rates of returns and drilling is coming back and so forth. And, hey, they're going to need downstream facilities. So we're building out processing in the Delaware. We've built two plants, building a third one now. And it bodes well for Eagle Ford, too.
So is the answer different between midstream and upstream? The upstream cowboys can go spend as much money as they want. We'll be here to take their volumes, or is that?
Hey, if the interest is there and the need is there for the demand for facilities, we'll try to accommodate.
All right, I think the Secretary of State might need you. John, what do you think?
No, I agree with Randy. I think from a midstream perspective solely, we have a lot of activity on the M&A front. There's probably a focus on acceleration, which should bode well for infrastructure development. Certainly, we're focused on opportunities. We see large opportunities in the Delaware, especially in the southern Delaware. So lots of M&A should be supportive of what we want to do as a company.
Got it. Eric, you want to take a stab at Permian as a bubble?
Actually, I do, actually. So there's a couple things going on, right? So can you say it's a bubble? You know, it's hard to say. You won't know for 3 to 5 years. Here's what I can say, though. And I think we can say this with a reasonably high degree of certainty. I suspect that the Permian geology will continue to extend horizontally, and like many other basins do. If you go back to Marcellus or Utica or Haynesville, you know, kind of 5-10 years ago, they all had the same pattern, which was they would extend horizontally through the isopach. And so we expect that to continue in the Permian as well. The question then becomes, where do you want to be in the Permian over time? Delaware, Midland, definitely high prices. I've already said we have not been successful there yet to date, although we would absolutely look to play there over time. I think our particular view is, you know, we have a bit of an off-spec business model, so we're not kind of trying to play the on-spec game. The off-spec business model works just fine. We're willing to look at things that are maybe a little bit on the fringe side of the Midland Delaware, because we do think that the numbers are pretty lofty, and producers have to have a lot of things go right. The challenge happens to be, though, if you do believe that shale continues to be dynamic development, it also can put a lid on pricing for a while. And so our view has been you have to do this carefully. I'm not sure that we would necessarily want to be following all the producers around at $45,000 an acre or in some cases above, but we would look for key areas where we can get contracted volumes, put that in place over kind of a 5 to 10 year time frame if you can get it. So it's all about being selective. It's about being opportunistic, but you certainly cannot go after all volume because it's not going to be created equal in our view.
Chuck, we don't want to leave you out the Eagleford. Where are your break-evens there, and do you think maybe the EFS is being overlooked given how much focus there is on the Delaware and the Midland?
If it's overlooked, then we're thankful because that's an opportunity to continue growing our acreage position. So we applaud everybody for running the Permian as fast as they can. I think our only regret right now is that we were enjoying a really great time market. If we wanted to build processing plants, the skills were cheap, the steel was cheap, pipe was available. The Permian, because it's, you know, for relative to Eagleford, it's a Texas, you know, short drive to get up there. There's a lot of skilled trades that are being pulled up there, and relative to with our new acquisition, the incremental opportunities that we see there, we're going to probably have a little bit of price inflation that on at least on our side that we weren't hoping to enjoy the discounts for a little bit longer. What we've done, obviously, on the SN side is break apart kind of the drilling model, and by having a large acreage position, being able to really push down as much of the sustainable cost savings and keep those as long as possible to keep on kind of driving down. And we have so many DUCs that came with the Anadarko that the conversion starts on those kind of last night, I'm sure.
Got it.
It's we're glad everybody's headed to another basin. We hope that means that there's more opportunity available to expand our footprint. Because for our model to continue working and growing, we look for large, contiguous, really large. And that works for SN, and that then works for SPP to use those volumes as an asset on the other side.
It seems like exports of gas into Mexico are likely to be a huge driver of, you know, better pricing at Agua Dulce and potentially regional pricing. Are you concerned at all about crossing border issues, you know, whether it's the border adjustment tax or some sort of tax reciprocity from the Mexican side? Are there any concerns there about, you know, that potential growth market being stymied by policy somehow?
On the surface of it, I understand why the question. I think at the end of the day, if we're going to see cross-border action, it will appear as policy gets driven to be less energy and more direct manufacturing. And you think about the initial effects of NAFTA and stuff like that. I think that's where you'll see it more. At the end of the day, they have an energy need. That affects the populace kind of a first order issue. So I'm not expecting that it actually, I'm sure I would throw it out on the table if I were negotiating from their side as well. I don't think that that's a realistic long term.
Got it. Randy, back to the Permian. You guys have got a couple projects and obviously Permian takeaway capacity on the crude oil side. What is your view about the tightening of that market? And do you think all the low-hanging fruit in terms of projects that, you know, you and maybe Plains have to get crude out of the basin have been tapped, and we're looking at, you know, bigger, more expensive lines going from here? And just generally, where do you see the potential takeaway market there?
You know, on the crude oil side, you do see tightening, and you know, just read again, kind of our internal fundamentals group, as well as what you read in the analyst notes, you're looking at a probably 18-19 time frame, 90% to 95% utilization. If you know the 500,000 barrels a day plus of expansions that have been announced, you're looking at, call it 2.9 to 3.1 million barrels a day of takeaway and kind of matching supply. You know, after that, it just depends. I mean, the Delaware, primarily rich gas, Midland, you got your crude. It just depends on where the, you know, where the increased drilling occurs. We think it'll be tight and maybe need some more, either expansions or maybe it is another large pipe. I mean, there's some pipes out there that still could be expanded. You know, you could use the DRA, you know, to increase your capacity on some of these larger pipes, although most of the, I think what's coming out of the, on our pipe, we figure most of that would probably be condensate or lighter, you know, the lighter gravity. But it'll be tight, we think. And for natural gas and for the NGL side, you've got some takeaway there. We have available capacity on some of our existing pipes. I think there's some available capacity out there, but there's going to probably need to be some more NGL and gas, certainly gas takeaway. I don't think the Mexican market plus, you know, on the crude oil side, your refineries are pulling, what, 400 or so a day demand side. I think there's going to be a need for some more takeaway, both crude and natural gas.
Okay. John, you've got a stake in that fight as well. I'm curious about what you have to say on that.
Well, I think we agree with Randy. It's probably late 18, 19. I think there's been a lot of capacity expansions that have been announced in the last, you know, 6 months. You know, there probably are, you know, some low hanging fruit projects that you can see come online or expansions. You know, I think what we think about and also talk about with our sponsor is, if you know, new projects need to be underwritten, you know, is there an appetite for volume commitments coming you know, out of the last 2 year cycle? So.
Got it. I think I'll just pause there and see if there are any questions from the audience at this point. All right, seeing none, I'll keep going. Yeah, I want to find something that you guys disagree about to pep this up after that tax panel. So onshore versus offshore, Eric.
Oh, it's a topic of my near and deep.
Is the offshore the redheaded stepchild permanently?
Parts of it are, but not all of it. So, yeah, look, the big differentiation in the offshore is I think anyone who's talked to me recently at a conference or talked to us on the phone has been deep water versus shelf players. Shelf absolutely struggling, will likely continue to struggle. Those EUR dynamics just are very, very different than if you go into deep water. And so, you know, from our view, we are dominantly deep water players and do expect continued development there. I think we're continuing to see that today, and the infrastructure is continuing to build out, and so we're pretty positive about that. Shelf is going to struggle, and we expect that to continue as long as we're in this commodity price environment. So as we look to deploy capital, which there's not a lot of more capital that we have to deploy, but as we deploy capital, we will be doing it solely in the shelf to create an integrated platform that we're continuing to work on until this day. So I think if, as long as you are focused deep water on that infrastructure, it's a very attractive rate of return profile. Interior-wise, it's going to continue to struggle in the short run.
Any questions? Okay. I don't want to blindside you too much. I don't know if you guys were able to see the tax reform panel earlier. I mean, you guys all have different structures. I mean, Randy, you're IDR-less for years now, not as a function of the cycle, but for sort of distinct reasons. I'm curious what you guys think about the MLP simplification trend that's gone on here, cost of capital. I mean, one of the things that struck me about the tax reform panel earlier is, yeah, IDRs are an increasing burden over time, but, you know, Kelsey Warren on his call said, we can do, you know, one-off IDR givebacks, which is certainly a pretty simple solution that people have used in the past. And, you know, I think it's a stretch to say we're going to miss a project because of cost of capital when that tool is in your quiver. So I'm just curious if you guys have any thoughts on MLP structure going forward and how you feel you're positioned from a cost of capital standpoint.
You know, Ethan, we've looked at we've done a lot of internal evaluations looking at C corp structure, up C, monitoring closely Plains and PAGP to see how that trades and the valuation there. And the way we run our company, you know, we could you know, with our coverage, we could switch to a C corp. It would be some pain. You know, you'd have some issues. We have our largest owner owns 32% of stock, so. You know, there would be some tax issues there. But, you know, the last time tax reform was done, it took, 2 years? And that was done in the 80s. And President, I guess it was Reagan, did it a second term because he didn't want to do it first term. He didn't want to be a president. You know, he wanted a second term. So I don't know with Trump, who knows? I guess all cards are on the table. But and historically it's taken a while. It's, you know, that's quite a large undertaking, but hey, we can we're evaluating that internally as far as the C-corp.
In terms of, you know, it's hard to predict tax policy with Trump, but, you know, focusing on our specific situation, you know, coming out of a recent IPO with, you know, IDR structure, and, you know, being a sponsored MLP, we certainly like and value the alignment that it creates over a long period of time. I think, you know, to your comment, it's not black or white. There are probably interim or intermediate term solutions that you can do in terms of IDR givebacks. You know, I think where you've seen it become an issue is where you wait until it becomes an issue. So there's obviously ways to deal with it earlier. But we're fortunate that we're a ways away from having to think about simplification, though we do get the question sometimes.
Yeah, same here. I think a couple of NDR meetings we had yesterday I think IDRs came up on every meeting, and you know, you kind of look down at the latest distribution and you say, actually the day we get to have the IDR discussion is a great day. However, it does go back to the sponsor alignment. We sit as a peer to Sanchez Energy. We sit side by side. They're not our GP, though they are a significant LP holder. The GPs are held by the family, which is actually where inside of Sanchez Oil and Gas, where all the employees actually sit for both entities. So we kind of think it creates a little bit different model for alignment. But we still get the question. We get a lot of why aren't you GPLP, like the typical upstream and midstream development, and that's a little bit of our evolution, how we came about is through transformation. We were an LLC originally and a pure upstream, and so we're you know, kind of an 80% midstream fee base now. So I think we remain evolving. And we'll still get the IDR question. That's just we set the IDRs on our conversion documents from LLC to GPLP 2 years ago before we were making a distribution. So it's quite a ways away. You know, completely different commodity market.
You know, Ethan, the comment I would make regarding two things. One is the talk about the general partnership construct and the IDR and the cost of capital. To your point, it can be manually addressed, and it is often done on an audible basis. So it really becomes an issue of scale, really on nominal dollars, particularly when you get to a size like enterprise, right? It really starts to become a bigger issue at that point in time. When you're smaller, you can adjust it through more of a manual process on an ad hoc basis. I don't really worry about it until some eventual point in time. It is true that when you do have the conversation, it's a pretty good day because a lot of things have really gone pretty well for a whole host of parties. So the other thing I'd mention, though, regarding taxation and policy, even going back in the very kind of late 90s, this concept has still come up. It still has not perpetuated itself. It still has turned into nothing at the end of the day. But I'll have a slightly different take on it. I actually don't think it would be a bad thing if we were to structure to more of a C-Corp type focus. And the reason I say that is really twofold. Once you get through the shock and awe of it all, and there will be a valuation reset that I would suggest was probably temporary. And the reason why it would be temporary is because once people realize that you can actually make the coverage work through time, and it will be company specific, higher coverage, you'll do just fine. And you may not have a valuation reset at all. If you're struggling, you are already going to struggle anyway. This will make it worse, and you'll have to address some things anyway, which probably would have forced something sooner rather than later. So the reality, though, is from a capital allocation standpoint, the amount of capital you could accumulate, and Randy and I were talking about this prior to coming in here, the amount of capital you could accumulate would be substantially larger than you could today, just given the constructs you have regarding the MLP structure. And so I'm not convinced that it actually isn't something that could over time be a beneficial mechanism once everyone was sort of calibrated to their new lot in life. And I'm not sure it changes much on the IDR aspect of things. It just looks different. And you see it on a number of entities today. You look at the utility space and the valuations there relative to the MLPs, and the MLPs continue to grow faster and have higher payouts, but yet trade at a lower multiple in many cases. So it absolutely can work. Just the question of, it's just that, sometimes the unknown and the fear is worse than the actual reality, and I suspect that's the case here.
It would have a devastating effect on everybody's IR hotline in March and April, though.
That's absolutely true. It would shut it down.
The K-1 walkthrough with investor after investor after investor who hold other MLPs who have sometimes asked the same question every year. I don't know what we would do for 2 months. I guess we'd all go on vacation, I guess. That is March and April. It's very interesting.
Sir.
You've seen a number of acquisitions recently. Do you see this trend continuing?
We, as everybody here probably knows, we made an announcement last year for Williams, and it was one of those things where we went back and forth. Would have been a large merger. It was leaked, and valuation fell out of bed and didn't work. For Enterprise, we've always had a history of kind of, the acquisitions and organic growth projects, kind of a mix of that, and just looking back since our IPO in 98, and I don't have the slide in front of me, but I believe it is $36 billion in organic growth and $26 billion of acquisitions. So, we look at acquisitions for more of an opportunity to build footprint and add to what we have. We don't necessarily look for transforming. What we did last year was kind of a step out for us. So, I think 17, I think we're pretty optimistic about commodity price improvements, and so then, things improve. You typically see maybe more of an appetite, but we're going to continue down the road of, a kind of a combination of, if there's opportunities there for assets, we'll buy assets, but otherwise we'll just continue to build organically.
So who's going to buy Williams now?
I think they're just going to go it alone. They've changed their board around. It's they've done a good job.
Sure, we feel the same way. The Permian, we think you'll continue to see transactions, private midstream companies that are in field, both on the crude and the gas side. I think that trend continues for this year. We think companies are more constructive on assets. I think markets are more supportive. So generally, I think people are more excited about assets coming to market. I think there'll be a focus on getting in-field assets that can bring barrels to bigger systems. We entered into a JV with Plains to acquire a pipeline. From the Noble Midstream perspective, we're likely done in terms of acquisitions for this year in terms of third parties, but we'll continue to be opportunistic.
For us, there's an obvious group of underutilized assets sitting nearby us in South Texas. Unfortunately, those assets are held, some at a GP and some at an LP, and that makes a transaction difficult, and they have a lot of leverage that they have to work through. I think for them, they look down at the leverage that they have and say, by math, over time, I can pay this down, and the GPs get tired of writing checks to support that effort, then maybe those assets will become available. But it gets back to a balance between buy and build over time. Like Randy said, sometimes the underutilized assets are underutilized not by virtue of their ownership, but by the structure above, which interferes with the ability for those to sign up in good long-term value contracts. It's the hazard sometimes of different, more complex ownership structures.
Yeah, that ownership structure can also affect what you've seen also is a little bit of corporate M&A as well. I think you should expect that to continue, although, to Jerry's point, it does make a big difference in terms of how you think about it relative to private equity ownership, whether to the length of the holding, what their willingness to actually try to transact. I think our view, and my particular view, has been the space does need to continue to consolidate, specifically at the small and kind of mid-cap level. Largely, in an environment like this, it's even more important. I mean, if you thought it was important before, it's even more important now, just because the cost of capital has gone up, access to capital has become tightened, and the ability to just capture growth without putting external capital out is more difficult now. So our view has been that private asset sales are, while they're interesting, if they're cash outlay for small to mid-cap players, they're going to become tougher. Arguably, that probably puts larger players in a better spot. I think also, though, differently, it probably puts the smaller players in a corporate consolidation game in a better spot relative to some of the larger players. So I think there's kind of a tale of two cities there as it relates to corporate versus private.
All right, I think we will wrap it up there. We're back on track time-wise. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Nicholas, I think we're back on track.